This is Dr. Herb Bateman in his instruction on the general letters. This is session number one, the background of the general letters.
Hi, my name's Herb Bateman. This is the first in a series of videos on the general epistles or the general letters. And today we want to focus attention on the historical backgrounds of the general letters. Now, typically, when we think about historical background, we think about the authorship of the book. We think about where the book was written from, to whom was the book written, the dating of the book. And then we talk about other things like theological content, and we look at the structure of the book. But today for this video, I want to focus on the historical background of the book as it centers around the Greco-Roman world. Now for those other issues, authorship, dating, recipients, the place from where the author is writing, those type of questions are easily answered in books like An Introduction to the New Testament by Carson and Moo. Another good source that you might go to is one by Elwell and Yarborough in the Encountering the New Testament series. These are very fine works that would be extremely helpful for you as a student to delve in to some of the issues surrounding authorship, dating, province, and other such discussions. There's going to be certain assumptions that I'm going to make about each one of these letters concerning the dating that we will uncover as we continue to work our way through. But for this video, for this tape, I want to focus on historical background as it concerns the Greco-Roman world. Now, the reason I'm beginning there is because we look at the New Testament and we assume certain things about that historical backdrop. But let me illustrate why I want to focus a little bit more attention on understanding this Greco-Roman world by thinking about the United States. If I were to talk about the United States in its early beginnings, we would naturally focus on the 13 colonies of the United States and how those 13 colonies become states in and of themselves. But when we think about the United States today, the United States today consists of 50 states. How did we go from 13 states to 50 states? There's this gap. And unless you study history, unless you get informed about this gap, you don't really appreciate the perspective as someone looking at American history. So we have the 13 original states, and then we have a treaty with Britain that expands those states to include to be territory to the Mississippi. Then we have the Louisiana Purchase by Thomas Jefferson, and then we have Spanish territory that eventually gets consumed or assumed within our 15 states. So we look at history and we see the progress of the growth of America in such a way that we see the development of these 50 states. The same is true when we come to talk about Israel, or we talk about Judah during the time of Jesus. Now, I'm going to refrain from using the word Palestine because, frankly, Palestine is a nomenclature that was developed once Hadrian conquered Jerusalem in 135, I believe that's the date. Prior to the time of Hadrian, Palestine was always referred to as Judea. So I'm going to be referring to Judea in light of the fact that during the Greco-Roman period, that was the nomenclature for that geographical area, from northern Galilee all the way down to and through Idumea. So we're talking about Judea during the time of the Greco-Roman world. I think it's also helpful to be mindful of the fact that when we have Malachi, the closing of the New Old Testament, and Matthew, the opening of the New Testament, we have a gap in history. And oftentimes that gap in history is referred to the intertestamental period or the silent years. And though that is a common nomenclature for that period, I like to extend that period to include 515, when Haggai and Zechariah return and build the temple, completely rebuild the temple, to 70 AD, when the Romans destroy that second temple. So I'm expanding that silent year period to be from 515 BC to 70 AD and call that the Second Temple period. With that in mind, and I will talk about the Second Temple period, and my parameters are always going to be 515 BC to 70 AD. There's also recognition that there is an early Second Temple period and a latter Second Temple period. When I think about the early Second Temple period, I'm thinking about the time when Haggai and Zechariah, Ezra and Nehemiah, Malachi are all residing in the land and during this period of time. That's the early Second Temple period. That's when the temple is being has been rebuilt. That's when people are coming back into the land and they're reestablishing themselves in the land. The latter Second Temple period will be that time period just prior to the time of Jesus. We might even call it begin with the Maccabees, and we'll come back to the Maccabees in a minute. But the Maccabees on to the time of Roman domination in Judea. So we're talking about a Second Temple period, 515 BC to 70 AD. And when we talk about the Second Temple period, I make a distinction between the early Second Temple period and the latter Second Temple period. Now, in this early Second Temple period, we have, as I've already mentioned, people coming back from captivity. And you all remember the time when Nebuchadnezzar carried off into captivity people of Israel. Typically, we think of three deportations. But the big one happened in 586. And that's when he destroyed the temple, as well as eliminated or dismantled the Davidic dynasty. After 70 years, thereabouts, Babylon falls to the Persians, and a king by the name of Cyrus the Great encourages people to return to their homelands to rebuild their temples to their gods. He was not in favor of the way in which the Babylonians deported people from their homelands and destroyed their temples. Cyrus wanted to encourage people to return to their homelands and rebuild their temples. And so we have Haggai and Zechariah being recipients or people who that took advantage of that opportunity, came back to Jerusalem and rebuilt the temple. Now, as the people were coming back to Judea, they were settling just around Jerusalem. Geographically, people were settling in that immediate territory around the city of Jerusalem. Later on in Nehemiah, you can see where cities are creeping into north of that, into the territory known as the tribe of Benjamin in the Old Testament. But for the most part, they are confined to this very small geographical area. And so when Malachi closes, when the Old Testament closes, when God is no longer revealing himself through prophets like Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, the geographical area in which the Jews are residing is very small. But go to Matthew. And when we read in Matthew, we read how a king by the name of Herod is ruling over Judea, and the geographical area in which he governs is humongous. It is from northern Galilee all the way down through Idumea. Now, you can look up in a map, and I highly recommend if you don't own an atlas. Kriegel has a real nice Bible atlas called the Kriegel Bible Atlas, and it's done by Tim Doley. And you can see how the people returning from exile, graphically, you can see how they just kind of centered in that geographical area. So we need to ask ourselves, what happened? What happened between the time Malachi closes and Matthew opens? How is it that this geographical area emerged? Well, in order to examine that, we need to become a little bit familiar with two key players in the Greco-Roman world. In much the same way that if you wanted to examine the expansion of America, moving from 13 states to 50, you'd have to look at men like George Washington and major players who established those 13 states. You got to look at Thomas Jefferson and the purchase of the Louisiana Territory from Napoleon during his presidency. You'd have to look at Polk and some of his expansions later on in history. You need to see major players who are responsible for that expansion. The same is true when it comes to looking at the expansion of Judea. And some of this expansion in Judea occurs because of historical events that are happening in the world that are having direct impact on them. Now, most of what I'm going to say from here on out is found in a book I've written entitled Interpreting the General Letters. And actually, this text will serve as course notes for you as you work your way through this video. And so we're looking at the chapter that's entitled The Background of the General Letters. And we're going to focus our attention first on Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander the Great was a Greek who was from Macedonia, and he was a very proficient military leader. Duration as king was marked an earth-shattering beginning of the Greco-Roman world. He was born in 356 before the time of Jesus. He was taught by Aristotle. His father was the famous Philip of Macedonia. And Philip of Macedonia is very key to Alexander because he united those Greek city-states. But when his father died, Alexander took those Greek city-states and he set out on a mission. He set out on a mission first on to liberate the Greek city-states in Asia. Greek city-states like Sardis and Ephesus, Miletus. These were all Greek city-states that were under the control of Persian rule. And so Alexander first sets out to liberate those states. And once he liberates those Greek city-states, he moves into conquering the Persians. And so after a sequence of three major battles, the Battle of a river in Asia Minor, the Battle of Issus, the battle at Gagamala. Alexander has expanded the Greco world, and the economic language becomes Greek. He's a major personality in this developing of this, what we now call the Greco-Roman world of the time of Jesus. Unfortunately, he dies, and his empire is divided into four parts. And there is turmoil over who's going to control this geographic area we now call Judea. Mind you, the Jews are only living in a very small portion of this land. The rest of it is mixed Jew-Gentile, Gentile, and we've got this fighting over this geographical area between two Greek families, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Eventually, what happens, one of these Greek kings from Seleucid decides that he does not believe the Jews have the right to practice a religion. And so he forbids the Torah to be read. He forbids circumcision. He burns Torahs. He forbids the practice of festivals and feasts. And slaughters a pig on the altar in Jerusalem. Not a good idea. And so he tries to wipe out the Jewish faith. But we have a family whose surname is Hasmonean, but we typically read about the Hasmoneans as Mattathias, the father, Judas Maccabee, and then his brothers, Jonathan, Simon, and several others. To make a long story short, which you can read in the Apocrypha, book called First Maccabees, we read how Judas Maccabees establishes religious freedom first. He manages to reestablish religious freedom in 140 during the time of Hanukkah. The date escapes me right at the moment, but it will come back to me eventually. Reestablishes religious freedom in Judea. After he dies, his brother Jonathan establishes political freedom in 156. And then another brother, Simon, establishes total independence from the Seleucids. But it's from this Hasmonean family, beginning with Judas Maccabees, that an expansion is about to occur. Simon has a son. His son's name is John Hyrcanus. And when he becomes governor and he takes over the high priesthood, he expands Jewish territory from that little geographical area of Judah to include Idumea and Samaria. And he forces everyone in those territories to be Jews. Then his brother, Aristobulus, very short reign, but he managed to expand the kingdom into Galilee. And once again, forcing everyone to be converted Jews. And then the final brother, Alexander Janus, expands the territory beyond that to the coastal plains and even further north as well. And so it's because of this family, these Hasmoneans, that we have this geographical area where Jews are now living and residing in northern Galilee all the way down into south into Idumea. So when Malachi closes, they're located here in the center of Judea, in Judah. When Matthew opens, their kingdom, or the kingdom that Herod is actually ruling over, is the kingdom that the Hasmoneans established. Now, that is very important to Jewish people. As a matter of fact, Hanukkah is a celebration of this religious freedom that was reestablished. It's also during this time period that perspectives about worship are developed. But before I get there, I want to move on to the second key figure in history, and that is Caesar Augustus. Now, Caesar Augustus was born in 63, he was a nephew to Julius Caesar, and he's adopted into Julius Caesar's family, and he also receives inheritance from Julius Caesar. But Caesar Augustus' name at this time is Octavian, not Augustus. And Octavian, before he becomes Caesar, develops a relationship with a fellow by the name of Pompey. Pompey was a very prestigious general for Rome. He is known for three triumphants through the Roman through the city of Rome. One in Spain, one because of his victories in about the pirates, and then the third one because of his victory in Asia Minor and Judea. So his victories in Spain, victories over the pirates, victories in Asia Minor, he is a very well-known military leader, but he's not a very good politician. And they become at odds with one another. Now, when Pompey conquers Asia Minor, part of that conquering included Judea. That Hasmonean family, remember the Hasmonean family we spoke about? As time went on, two brothers fought over who was going to run the kingdom, that Judea kingdom. And they could not settle amongst themselves who would rule. And so they went to Pompey while Pompey was conquering and working his way through Asia Minor into Syria. And they went to Pompey and asked him to settle that disagreement. As a result of Pompey telling these two brothers, I'll sleep on it, the one brother was impatient, went to Jerusalem, and held himself up in that temple. Pompey, not very happy with that result, marched into Jerusalem, conquered the territory, and assumed it as part of Roman rule. And captives were carried into captivity and were part of Pompey's third triumphal procession in 63. And even though Julius Caesar and Pompey had a relationship, a ruling relationship early on, that relationship deteriorated. Eventually, Pompey and Julius Caesar fought with one another. Pompey lost, Caesar Augustus, Octavian. Octavian and Pompey fought with one another. Octavian wins over Pompey and he assumes control over the entire Roman world, which we refer to as the Greco-Roman world. And he sets into motion what they call the Pax Romana. Now, Caesar Augustus establishes this Pax Romana, which meant the peace of Rome. There is to be peace throughout Rome. And he wanted people in power that could maintain the peace throughout his kingdom. And one of the reasons Herod the Great becomes king is he's able to maintain peace in Judea. And so he has a good relationship with Caesar Augustus. And because of that, and it's also important to realize that up until the time of Pompey coming to Judea, the Judeans typically had a good relationship with Rome. Judas Maccabees sent envoys to Rome to develop an alliance with Rome. Jonathan, his brother, sent envoys to Rome to maintain that alliance. Simon, another brother of Judas, sends envoys. So there was always this relationship that was healthy until Pompey invaded Rome, or invaded Judea. And at which point Judea came under the auspices of Roman rule, and Herod is made king. All this factors into some of the feelings and the animosities that existed in Judea later on in the New Testament, which will develop in our next segment as we talk about the theology of the epistles. Okay, so we have, so Herod is made king by Caesar Augustus, and there is a pretty healthy relationship between Judean leaders and Rome. And as I've already said, that initiation of that relationship was initiated with by Judas Maccabee, later reinforced by Jonathan, and then again reinforced by Simon. I want to once again emphasize this expansion that occurs. Because when we think about this Hasmonean period, it's healthy and helpful to recognize that there is a liberation from the Greeks in the land. Now, Judea is both, the language of the people is being transformed from Aramaic to Greek. Greek is becoming the economic language in the territory. Though Aramaic is still spoken, Hebrew is still is spoken by the religious leaders. It's a trilingual country. So even though this liberation from Greek rule exists, the language of the Greeks still is maintained. We have the expansion of the territory through the sons of Simon, as once again, we have the first son, John Hyrcanus, expanding into Samaria and Idumea. We have the expansion of Aristobulus. One of the things that Aristobulus does that is not very well received at all is that he decides to put a royal diadem on his head, a royal crown. Now, up until this point, Judas Maccabees is seen as a military leader. When Jonathan comes along and he establishes political freedom and able to govern politically this little geographical area of Judea, he is considered a high priest. Simon, his brother, is the same way. He is high priest with governing powers. And so with this liberation from Seleucid rule, we have this developing story within Jewish history concerning these three brothers. And to what extent are we going to accept them as high priests? This starts causing some fractions within the community, and we have one group that resists this, these brothers, as well as the subsequent leaders who are responsible for the expansion of Judea by creating a sect known as the Essenes. We have the Pharisees that are also struggling with this family as well. So we have some tensions emerging because of some of these shifts in power. So we have the liberations from the Seleucid rule from Judas Maccabee, Jonathan, and Simon. Then we have the expansion of this Judean territory by men like John Hyrcanus, Aristobulus, who decides to put a crown on his head, so now he's considered a royal priest, and then Alexander Janus does the same thing, puts a crown on his head, and he is a royal priest. And the struggle that emerges at this time is that neither one of these men are from the line of David. And so we have some theological developments emerging at this time. I address some of those theological developments in a book that I've co-authored with Daryl Bach and Gordon Johnston entitled Jesus the Messiah, Tracing the Promises, Expectations, and Coming of Israel's King. And within this book, in the second section, I speak about and address some of these developments. And a lot of the developments that we see about the Messiah figure is emerging and evident in Qumran documents evident in some works called pseudepigrapher works, falsely ascribed works like the Psalms of Solomon, and other such works. There's not a lot, but one of the things that emerges is that there's a discontent with these Hasmonean rulers to the point where they want them removed and they begin looking for a Messiah figure, known as who will be, we refer to him as Jesus, but at that time, the person they were looking for was a military leader. In this work, I provide a chart that reveals the different perceptions of this Messiah figure. On the one hand, there's this presentation of being totally human. He's from the line of David. He's human, and he's going to have offspring. There's another aspect about this Messiah figure that comes through is that he's a military leader. He's a political leader. He's a righteous leader. And another final aspect about this Messiah figure that we read in these texts is that he's endowed with God's Spirit. He has a unique relationship with God. And he's an interpreter of the law. And so we have this presuppositions, these various presuppositions, these various portraits of Jesus, of a Messiah figure that is developing in the land. So when Jesus comes on the scene, we have a group of people, a group of religious people, that are looking for a messianic figure that is going to be military, that is going to establish David's kingdom based upon 2 Samuel 7:14, Psalm 2:7. You'll see these texts repeated several times in the Psalms of Solomon, chapter 17. Lord, wouldn't this be a great time for you to send your Messiah figure to fulfill your promise to David? And the Psalm of Solomon's, whoever that author is, he really does not like the Hasmoneans. I mean, they clearly say, get rid of the Hasmoneans. And so on the one hand, they're very happy the Hasmoneans are gone, and praise God for Pompey, because this piece of literature was written right after Pompey's invasion in Judea. But by the same token, they're happy that Pompey did it, but in the same psalm, it's like, but let's get rid of the Romans too. Let's get rid of this Gentile rule. So they want the Hasmoneans out of the picture. They want the Romans out of the picture. They want God to send his messianic son of promise to rid Israel, to rid Judea of both the Hasmonean family and Roman rule. And we see this at times also in the Qumran scrolls. As we've already mentioned, there was a dynastic dispute within the Hasmonean family that resulted in Pompey having to have to step in and resolve this dispute, which resulted in the Hasmonean family losing control over the royal priesthood they had established, to where Caesar Augustus appoints Herod the Great to be king over Judea, and then Herod in turn appoints a high priest to rule in Jerusalem, but he's a puppet to Herod. Herod cannot be priest because he's a half-Jew. Now, do you remember when I was telling you about John Hyrcanus and how John Hyrcanus, in his expansion of the territory from this little geographic area of Judea to include Samaria and Idumea, he conquered the Idumeans and forced them into accepting Judaism. Herod's grandpappy was part of that conversion and actually given leadership in Idumea as governor of Idumea. And so we have Herod growing up in a political family that has been given political power by a previous Hasmonean. He actually marries into that Hasmonean family. He is a very astute man of politics. He knows how to work the system. He knew how to work it in Judea, and he learned how to work it in Rome. And so he's a man who is able to make this transition when Rome comes into power to play the roles he needs to play to gain acceptance by Caesar Augustus to be made king of Judea. So at first, the Jews of this period of time tolerated the relationship they had with Rome. But that toleration with Rome ended with the coming of Pompey and the establishing Herod as king. And with the establishment of Herod as king, we have a further escalation of this for this person who's going to fulfill God's covenant to reestablish David's dynasty in Judea. It begins with the Hasmoneans. We see this discontent with the Hasmonean leaders in power accepting this royal dynasty for themselves as royal priest. We see it escalate and develop even further under Herod the Great. So, as far as the world is concerned, we're living in a period of time, the Greco-Roman world, where Herod the Great is considered king of Judea when the book of Matthew opens. Naturally, Herod does not live very long after Matthew begins. Matter of fact, Herod the Great is only mentioned once in the New Testament. The kingdom of Judea is divided into three parts with his sons. Philip, one son, taking very northern Galilee. Antipas, taking Galilee. And a fellow by the name of Archelaus, getting Samaria and Judea. And once again, Caesar Augustus is responsible for that those divisions and those regional assignments for rulership. Archelaus ends up not being a very good leader, and he's relieved of his role as king or tetrarch of Samaria and Judea. And that geographical area comes under the rule of Roman governors. And we have subsequent number of Roman governors that are maintaining political peace in that area. Hence, we have Pontius Pilate being a governor of that geographical area when Jesus is on earth and towards the end of his life. So we have this political setup that the Jewish people, the Jewish religious leaders, and I think that's important to recognize because the religious leaders are the driving force behind the populace of Judea. They're the educated. They're the students of Scripture. They set the theological pace for the country. They stir the people concerning their theological perspectives. And it's within this time frame that we have Jesus ministering. It's in this time frame where Jesus is defining his messiahship, not on their theological terms, but on his terms. Need to mention one other thing, and we'll continue to build on my construct as we think about this background for the general letters. It's important. When the people are deported from Judea by Nebuchadnezzar in 586, the Jews found themselves living in foreign countries with Gentiles. They have no temple. They have no country. And we see in one apocryphal book called the Tobit, a man pondering, how do I live as a Gentile with a bunch of pagan? How do I live as a Jew among a bunch of pagan Gentiles? He's considered a righteous man in this book, and this somewhat romantic novel that is written about him. It is a novel. It's written around 200. Even though it's placed during a time when he supposedly has been taken captive during, even before Nebuchadnezzar, by Sennacherib of the Assyrians. He finds himself in Media, but he's a righteous man. And one of the things that we see in Tobit, and we see in a lot of the apocryphal writings, is this wrestling with, how do I demonstrate my covenantal loyalty to Yahweh, to God, when I have got no temple? I got no priest. And some of the things that get established is Jewish people bury the dead. That becomes very important. Jewish people make sure they circumcise. Jewish people read the Torah. Jewish people practice the festivals. Even they're not home, they can't go to the temple. They recognize and they honor festivals. And they give alms to the poor. These things become part and parcel of demonstrating my covenantal loyalty with Yahweh as a Jew. Doesn't matter where I'm at. I practice these things to demonstrate, I love you, God. This is how I have my relationship with God, is through these practices. So let's come back to New Testament times, where we have Jesus, first off, wrestling with the theological construct of a Messiah figure who's going to be military and going to rid the land of Judea of all bad Jews who don't tote the right religious political party, religious line. The Essenes are great at seeing themselves as being the son of light, and everybody else, Jew and Gentile, being the sons of darkness. See? So you've got to toe the right theological line here. So we have these factions within Judaism about Messiah. Then we've got this political issue, or we've got this other issue of, how do I demonstrate loyalty to God? Well, it's by burying the dead. So Jesus, on the one hand, is defining messiahship on his terms, and we see this in the Gospel of Mark. He tells people, shh, don't tell anybody I'm Messiah. What's he trying? How is he describing himself as Messiah? Well, who is this man? He's the Messiah. The second part of Mark is, what type of Messiah is he? He's a suffering Messiah. He's going to be betrayed. He's going to suffer. He's going to die, and he's going to be raised again. Do the disciples understand? No. Why? Because they've got this theological construct about who this Messiah figure is and what's he going to do. And Jesus is saying, I'm not that Messiah figure. And Jesus is striving to define Messiah in his own terms. Likewise, covenantal loyalty no longer is going to be because the dead bury the dead. Isn't that what Jesus says? A fellow comes up to Jesus and says, hey, I want to follow you, but I want to wait until I bury my father. And Jesus says what? Let the dead bury the dead. And so he's challenging these covenantal loyalties as well. He's challenging the theological construct as Jesus as Messiah, and he's challenging the construct that, how do I have a relationship with God? It's through honoring and obeying and following through on these covenantal loyalties. You want to have a relationship with Jesus, with God? You do it through Jesus. You do it through Jesus. And so what we have when we look at these general letters, particularly James, Jude, Hebrews, that are written to Jewish believers, one of the things that they are wrestling with is this paradigm shift. They're wrestling with what they have believed all along about a Messiah figure, and authors are trying to redefine and make sure they understand Jesus truly is the Messiah, the one sent by God, based upon the terms that Jesus set. They're also wrestling with, how do I live as a Christian, a Jewish Christian? What does it mean to follow Jesus? To what extent are these covenantal loyalties part and parcel of my life? We also have 1 Peter and 2 Peter written, and the Johannine letters written to people in Asia Minor, addressing issues there as they're wrestling as Greek followers of Jesus, Greek and Jewish followers of Jesus. And what does that mean? And wrestling with teachings and making sure they stay on track with who Jesus truly is. The general letters are set in a period of time known as the Greco-Roman period. Politically, it is a period of time run by Caesars. Most of the time, Nero is the Caesar in power at this time. Caesar Augustus has long passed, and Nero is Caesar and Rome, and ruling over the Greco-Roman world. We have Jesus being followed by people in Judea. We have Jesus being followed by people throughout the Roman Empire, wrestling with questions about being a follower of Jesus. And then these letters are written to people throughout the Greco-Roman world to address issues that are unique to each one of those geographical areas. So as we continue to think our way through and study the general letters, keep this in mind, that the background for these letters is rooted in a lot of history that can be even further developed and studied. One work I'd encourage you to read would be Shore's Volume 1 on the history of the Jewish people during the time of Christ. There are other works as well. They would be supplement to what we're discussing here today. Until next time, we will see you later, and we'll talk about the genre of the general letters. Thank you.
This is Dr. Herb Bateman in his instruction on the general letters. This is session number 1, the background of the general letters.